Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Let's go around the horn and say good morning to the guys, and we start with one, Chris Canty. Good morning, Chris Canty. How are you?
What's up, Dave? How you doing?
I'm okay.
All right. Good weekend?
Yeah, I mean, as good as one of our weekends can be, I guess, at this point. Not a ton going on. But everything's fine. You guys are fine. Everything good?
Yeah, everything is good. What do you mean, not a ton going on? We had a bunch of sports this weekend, Dave. We had UFC 249, which was awesome. We had The Last Dance last night. What you mean? It was nothing going on.
Well, I just meant overall. There's not a lot of choices.
Well, I'm just saying, you're probably talking about the best sports weekend we've had in the last 2 months.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I watched tennis on like some court in the middle of a jungle. Did you see that?
Are you talking about the one I was trying to watch the K show? Are you talking about the one that was on instead of the K show?
Yes. Yeah. I said on Saturday, I turned on the television to watch the K show on, I guess it was Friday. I don't remember what day they all meld together.
I think it was Friday, yeah.
And there was tennis just on a court in the middle of green. And,
the housing development, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like Del Boca Vista, and it was in a chain-linked fence was around it. There was one referee, no ball boys, with guys I've never heard of. And, Rick, it was so funny because the announcer clearly wanted to, you know, promote what a big event this was. And he says, I don't even remember the guys that were involved. It was a match of two guys I've never heard of. And he says, can you not see to the Coloranos, can you not see this guy being a top 10 player in the next 3 to 5 years? On the color analyst, so he thinks, he goes, no, I can't see that at all. This guy's not even remotely on that level. No, there's nothing I can see.
That actually has been, I mean, between watching that and then watching some of the KBO, I mean, that's actually one of the best things so far to come out of this. Even watching some of the shows that we watch on the Food Network, like the Pioneer Woman's doing, you know, the quarantine editions where she has her kids filming her and they have like, Her pepper, you know, shaker explodes, or she like sets the spoon on fire. Like listening to some of these play-by-play guys, listening to Boog Shambi do one of the KBO games, just because it's so relaxed, because they're doing it from home, just the blatant honesty when he's doing the game, and he's like, "Yeah, I can't wait for this final out." Like he's just done with the game. Like he's so bored by it, he can't wait to be done. I love it. I kind of like it a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit of refreshing honesty. There is nothing shy of refreshing honesty when it comes to Michael Jordan and The Last Dance. We see it in last night. I guess last night was the episode or the two episodes, Rick, that he was a little bit concerned about wouldn't make him look good. And look, he is a guy that at any cost wants to win. And I think that we've seen that in the first 8 episodes and specifically last night of The Last Dance.
Yeah, I heard a great quote, and this is, you know, going through trying to things, you know, find things to get the guys on my hockey team motivated, to get these kids motivated, trying to go through like all these quotes and everything else. And I'll never forget one of the quotes that I really liked was, on bad teams, no one leads. On good teams, coaches lead. On great teams, players lead. And I mean, I think last night watching those episodes, I mean, that's what Michael Jordan did. And I think it was smart on Phil Jackson's part to kind of realize that if this team was going to be great, when you have your best player willing to lead the way that Michael Jordan was going to lead, that he'd get the best out of everyone around him. But I think, you know, when you see how Jordan reacted at the end of, you know, episode 7 and how emotional he got, I mean, there's a lot of sacrifice that goes into that. Personal relationships, friendships. I mean, that's a lonely place to be, man. I mean, look at who his best friends were. His dad was one of his best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's hanging with security guards. And then, I mean, it actually says on, you know, when you watch the show, best friend was his personal assistant.
Right.
I mean, that's who he was closest to. Like, he was willing to sacrifice those friendships, those relationships with his teammates to make sure he would get the best out of them, which in turn, you know, would get the best out of the team and they'd win, you know, win those championships.
But I think that's in part why he got so emotional at the end, though, Rico. Like, he finally broke down and he said, if you don't want to play that way, then don't play that way. I think Michael Jordan cared about his teammates, but he was a little rough on them just because he had to set the bar that high in order to accomplish his ultimate goal, which was competing for championships. He actually went as far as to say it in the documentary. Like, he wanted those guys to win with him. He didn't want to just be the guy that did it by himself. But he recognized that he was going to ruffle some feathers. He was going to be tough on a lot of guys. I mean, listen to him outline the Steve Kerr incident. Like, he talked about it. Phil Jackson calling ticky-tack fouls in practice, and he was upset at Phil Jackson because he thought he was doing the team a disservice by not toughening them up. He said, you're not going to be able to beat the New York Knicks like this. Like, we have to be more physically rugged. And then him and Steve Kerr get into a back and forth, and he ends up punching Steve Kerr in the eye. But I think it shows a lot about who Jordan was from a sports character standpoint, the fact that he called back to the practice facility on his way home that night, got the number for Steve Kerr, called him and apologized, and said that it had nothing to do with him. And you heard what Steve Kerr had to say. Like, Steve Kerr said him and Jordan from that moment on had a really good relationship because Jordan realized, you know, the competitive fire that Steve Kerr had, the intensity that he had, even though he wasn't as talented. He said they never had a problem from that moment on. They had a great relationship. So I think that Jordan was okay as long as he felt like your drive to compete and to win was comparable to him. And if you didn't have that, then it was going to be, in his own words, hell for you. But I think deep down, Jordan cared about all of his teammates. And if you look at it in retrospect, he probably realizes that those guys feel a way toward him, and that's just not how he felt about them.
I'm so torn in watching it because I watch a segment. I'm like, God, what an amazing leader. And the fact that he could take anything and he made stuff up, right? The LeBradford Smith story about how he, at the end of the game, he's like, yeah, good game, Mike. He made stuff up to motivate him. I love that. I love that, you know, he needed new and creative and inventive ways to just drive himself and push himself. I love that. So, like, I'll watch a segment and be like, God, I respect this guy so much. And then there's times when you watch it and they go around to BJ Armstrong or Bill Wennington or whoever, and they're like, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you want me to tell you. He was very difficult. I didn't consider him really to be a friend. Like, all these guys have, they hem and they haw in trying to answer what they thought about Michael Jordan. So, you know, I think it's, I will watch a segment, a scene, and just kind of flip-flop as I watch during the course of any show, because I think he's a deep, interesting, fascinating guy.
Yeah, but here's the thing though, Dave. I mean, usually, you know, when you hear comments like this from players as far as their relationship, I mean, if, you know, you just listen to, you know, Bill Wennington or Steve Kerr or BJ Armstrong, who really, I mean, after the last couple episodes comes out as the real winner. I mean, between getting Jordan motivated after celebrating the way he celebrated, all of a sudden he turns it on, and then, you know, bringing him back during the Major League Baseball strike to come, you know, see the guys and kind of reignite that fire to bring him back to the team. Those are conversations. Those are questions you'd ask a player about the coach. You know, the great coaches. You know, how do you feel about Bill Belichick? How do you feel about Bill Parcells? You know, when you ask Chris, you know, how did you feel about, you know, Tom Coughlin? Like, and when he goes back and he thinks about it at the time, you know, Tom Coughlin's not easy to play for. He demands the best. Bill Parcells demands the best. And in the moment, you don't really like him. But then, you know, when you take a step back, you realize what he was doing was in your best interest and he got the best out of you. I mean, that's what Jordan did. Like, Jordan was kind of, I mean, he was the best player. And he was also, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, he took on the role as the coach too, to hold guys accountable. Like, he was willing to be the bad guy, which a lot of guys aren't willing to do. Scottie Pippen wasn't willing to do it. He led differently, but it wasn't.
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't as effective as what Jordan was doing.
No, it wasn't, because it didn't end in them winning a championship, and that's the difference. That's what we're talking about. So at the end of it, Jordan's being emotional and reflecting back on the relationships that he had, and you recognize the cost of winning, the cost of leadership. It cost him some relationships that he might have in place today. He doesn't have those, or at least not to the degree that he should have those based on the success that his teams were able to have. And that's because he was so hard on guys. But I mean, that's what it takes, man. I mean, it's not easy to have that kind of sustained success at the highest level of sports, because we keep talking about it. The difference in the margin of talent is not that great. What separates you is your mentality, your discipline, your dedication. I mean, listening to Jordan talk about Scott Burrell. He was like, yeah, Scott Burrell had all the talent in the world, but he didn't have any discipline.
Poor Scott.
He wasn't
Burrell.
Serious. You know what I mean? Like,
that point, guy.
Like, think about how curt he was in that description. Like, Michael Jordan didn't pull any punches, and he let Scott Burrell know that every single day, just the way that he talked to him in practice. I mean, that's just one of those things. But Jordan felt like, if I was hard on these guys, if they could stand up to me, then I know they wouldn't wilt under pressure in the playoffs trying to win a championship.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I mean, and Chris, you'll go through this when you have kids, but I mean, Dave, I mean, you have kids. I mean, it's kind of the fine line you walk as a dad, isn't it? where, I mean, you want to get the best out of your kids, and sometimes you feel like you got to be hard on them, and it's
sure.
emotionally it's tough because you want to be their friend. I mean, you want to give them everything that they want or they ask for, but the realization is that you can't. And there'll be times when your kids resent you and they'll tell you they hate you, whatever they end up saying. And I think that weighs on you though, doesn't it? I mean, in a perfect world, don't you think Michael Jordan would like to have had the success he had and then have all these
sure.
unbelievable friendships?
If he thought he could have had the ultimate success with, you know, sugarcoating things and being easy on these guys, he probably would have done it. But it's got to be, I mean, a heck of a burden to have the team walk on eggshells around you consistently. A lot of the guys respect you, but maybe not like you all that much. And to go out there and score 35, 40 points with 10 rebounds and 8 assists and dominate, you know, game after game after game, that's a hell of a burden he had.
Yeah, it's draining. And I think that's why you see, I mean, as they go back and forth between the runs, is that just mentally, not so much physically, but just mentally it was enough. Like, he had enough. When you make that decision, and Chris and I always, you know, kind of remind you of this, every time, like Tom Brady, Michael Jordan, these great leaders, Derek Jeter, it's a decision you make every single day, is to be that guy.
Yep.
And for him to do that for as long as he did, I mean, let's not forget, too, I mean, the years before, you know, they started winning championships, and then to go through the 3 win, I mean, between that and then have his dad murdered and everything else,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he was done. Mentally, he just had nothing left in the tank, and he needed that year and a little bit of weight to kind of, you know, reignite that fire.
I also think he walked away from the game because his father did die. And before his father passed, he and his dad talked about going into baseball and trying to pursue that passion as well. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he told his dad that that's something that he's going to do. And then once he got to that 3rd championship, once he accomplished something that Isaiah Thomas, Magic Johnson, and Larry Bird, his contemporaries, didn't do, then it gave him the opportunity to secure his legacy and then go into that foray with baseball. And that was something that he promised his dad he wanted to do. Like, his dad passing, I think, led to, in part, him deciding, you know what? I'm going to do this. I told my dad I was going to do this, and I'm going to fulfill that. I'm going to, you know, go ahead and go into that because I've earned the right to do that. You know what I mean? Like, it was just one of those things that, for him, he even said it in the documentary, like, from a basketball standpoint, I had accomplished everything that I thought I needed to accomplish. There was no other challenge. And I think baseball was that other challenge, but him and his dad also shared that common bond, that love for baseball. So I think, you know, his dad passing just pushed him a little further in that direction and allowed him to take a break from basketball.
Now, he wasn't, you know, major league caliber baseball player, but it amazes me that a guy could not really play baseball. Rick, and you play baseball now, could not play baseball for really 15 years, pick up a bat, train for it, and be even capable of playing at the AA level. It's remarkable and shows you what kind of an athlete he was. And I'm not saying that he was a major league caliber player, because clearly he wasn't.
Yeah, but time out. But time out. I mean, you can say that. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, in reality, is it fair to Michael Jordan that you take him from, you know, NBA superstar and stick him in AA because of the media? No. I mean, AA, I mean, anyone you ask, I mean, that's, you know, of the minor league systems, one of the most competitive. I mean, you're going to get the best prospects from all these teams, for the most part, in AA. So, I mean, he should have started off in, you know.
Yeah, he should have started off in summer league.
Rookie ball. Yeah, rookie ball, single A. And the fact, I mean, he jumps in, and this is something that I thought was interesting last night. No one ever talks about. It's 13-game hitting streak to start.
To start, yeah.
And then all of a sudden he got the Pedro Serrano treatment where they just started him throwing him off-speed pitches that he couldn't hit. But he stole 30 bases. You could see how fast he was. And he drove in 50 runs. I mean, that's not too shabby, man.
I'm not saying he wasn't capable. My point was that to not play baseball for 15 years and to come back and play at the AA level, which, you know, is a high brand of baseball, and to be capable and competent just shows you the kind of athlete that the guy was.
Yeah, he was a freak athlete. And I think the other thing, too, was you see how competitive he is and how competitive he still is. But it was like almost an opportunity for him to continue to be competitive and have, you know, the thrill of the competition, but just to kind of have no expectations, right? Mm. Like, no, he could just be one of the guys. Like, he could go just compete, have fun, enjoy himself, as opposed to, you know, every single day with the media and everyone else just focused on being the best, winning championships.
Like, yeah, he didn't have the burden of having to set the standard for the rest of the guys in the locker room. Like, he just didn't have that. Like, Dave just talked about it a little bit earlier, but he didn't have to worry about all of those expectations. He didn't have to worry about it being, you know, championships being the focus of it. Like, he could actually just go out there and enjoy the game. And, you know, that was something that a lot of people are critical of him for, because they felt like he was taking something away from them by not playing basketball. And I just think that was one of those things where he had earned the right to do whatever he wanted to do. And Jerry Reinsdorf thought as much, because he continued to pay him his bull salary while he played in Double A. So I just think that was one of those things that people unfairly criticized Jordan for. And he had every right to do as a player and as a person. Like, clearly he needed a break. He was burnt out. You can see how intense a competitor he was. Like, that's a lot for any person. And so he had to take a step away from it, especially with what he was dealing with away from sports in his personal life. So I just think that was one of those things that people unfairly criticized him for. And I thought it was wild that people in the media were jumping to the conclusion and trying to connect his father's death with his gambling, and that's the reason why he walked away from basketball. I thought that was wildly inappropriate.
That was a big deal at the time. A big deal. I don't know if you remember at the time that this is the reason that he left the NBA.
No, I do remember it, Dave. Yeah. I just think that was completely inappropriate. I mean, we heard Andrea Kramer
based on no documentation whatsoever.
Yeah, she was like, well, if you connect the dots, you can understand why somebody would come to that conclusion. And I was sitting there thinking while I was watching it, what dots are there to connect? There are no dots. I mean, we heard grumblings about Michael Jordan's gambling, but I mean, him gambling $50,000 ain't the same as us gambling $50,000. Michael Jordan was at another level financially. So, I mean, I just, to say that his problem, his addiction led to his father's untimely death, that's a hell of a leap to make.
It really is.
Especially if you're a responsible journalist.
Well, it's kind of gross when you think about it. I mean, unless you have some actual factual evidence here, how can you come out with unless it's purely conjecture, which is also kind of gross, right? I mean, how do you can't just come out with something like that.
Oh, you can't.
Well, you had that. No, I mean, you had that, and then you had the other theory was that this was an 18-month suspension that was kept under wraps. Like, this is he was going to get suspended, or he could walk away from basketball and go do whatever he wanted to do, and he chose baseball. Which is, I mean, you think about it, is ridiculous, because you're talking about the greatest player of all time. I mean, what he's done for the NBA, that you're gonna suspend him? Really?
But what would be the point of that? Like, you would think that if you're gonna suspend him, you'd want it to be known that you've suspended the guy, not to have him.
Because you don't want to embarrass him. I mean, the whole point is you don't want to embarrass him. Right? Like, I mean, he's the golden goose. You're not gonna, I mean, the same reason why, I mean, you think that Adam Silver would want to suspend LeBron James?
Of course not.
Okay. So, I mean, that's, I mean,
but wouldn't you? I mean, if he's the golden goose and you know what he's doing for the game, wouldn't you almost turn a blind eye and just let him continue along and not in quotes suspend him for 18 months quietly?
Well, it'd be out of sight, out of mind. Like, if there was something to that, then he'd be out of sight, out of mind. You'd forget about it, and then people wouldn't start continue to dig into it. I guess would be the mindset.
I guess I don't know the whole.
Well, the reason why people were trying to connect dots, I would imagine, is because it doesn't make any sense. Like, you'd have a hard time wrapping your mind around, how a guy coming off of three championships, establishing himself as the greatest of all time, team still, the favorites to win another championship would just walk away. People can't make sense of that.
Right. Well, yeah, it looked like at the end of 93, he had nothing left, though. Like, he was completely emotionally and physically spent and had nothing left to go continue to play basketball.
Yeah, but people don't know. People can't. I mean, there's no empathy for an athlete that says, I'm just, it's just mentally I can't take it. But regular people can't wrap their mind around that.
Yeah, but clearly this guy is different from a mentality standpoint than anybody else. And so we're trying to assign a level of logic based on our perspective, but that doesn't work when you start talking about what goes through the mind of the most dominant athlete on the face of the planet. And I'm not saying, and I get why the conversation goes in this direction, because he was on top of the world. Why would he leave at this point? But clearly his mind doesn't work like everybody else's.
Mm-mm.
Otherwise he would be like everybody else. So I just think, when folks are trying to, look at this situation and understand why he did it, you almost have to take what he says at face value, just because we're not capable of having that type of intensity when it comes to anything that we do, like Michael Jordan. We just, most people don't have that.
I don't think you can. I almost think it's impossible to have that level of intensity every single day with everything you do. I mean, you saw at the end of the, what was it, the, when they lost to the Magic and his trainer said, all right, you know, you want to get back at it 2 months, 3 months. He said, tomorrow. Like, the, no, people don't do that. People that you saw when they were filming Space Jam and how he would have these unbelievable pickup games after filming all night and then waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Like, it's not normal what he was able and the way that his mind worked. It's just, it's not the norm, Chris.
It's not the norm, Dave, but sidebar, how about Warner Brothers building a gym, full court basketball with workout equipment on the studio lot? That's awesome, insane.
Huh? Well, that's what you get when you're Michael Jordan.
But then Reggie Miller was talking about it. He's like, he didn't know how Jordan did it. Like, he's got a 6 or 7 a.m. call time to shoot Space Jam, and then he plays pickup basketball for 3 hours in the evening, and then he works out after that. Like, people couldn't figure out how he did it. Like, it's unbelievable, but, I mean, that just shows you how driven Michael Jordan was. And really, he didn't care what anybody else thought.
No.
Like, it didn't matter what everybody else thought to him. Like, it was just like, okay, here's my goal, here's my objective, and I'm going to accomplish it, hell or high water, whatever it does to the personal relationships with my teammates, personal relationships outside of basketball, it doesn't really matter. This is my focus, and this is what I'm going to set out and accomplish, and nobody or nothing is going to get in my way, not even shooting this movie for Warner Brothers. That's not going to get in the way of me and my quest to get back to the top of the sport. It's unbelievable.
See, that's what makes it most impressive watching this documentary, is that it's one thing if just like regular people don't understand. But I mean, the fact that, you know, you're talking about some of the greatest basketball players of all time, they don't understand. Like,
how
they don't
could
get
you
it.
Understand this?
Well, you can't. I mean, that's why this documentary is must watch television. To try to get in the mind of someone like Michael Jordan and to like actually, you know, what goes through his mind, you know, trying to motivate himself every single day. I will say this, though. One of my biggest takeaways from those two episodes was, does he actually win 6 championships if he doesn't walk away for that year and a bit?
If he plays 94 and 95?
If he just continues on, like everything's okay, doesn't take that mental break, does at some point he just break down to the point where he never gets it back?
Could. I mean, and then there's a lot of people that say, oh, they would have just won 8 straight championships and walked their way, you know, those 2 years that he missed and the 3 years on the back end. We don't know.
I don't know if somebody mentally that tough was going to break. I'm uncomfortable saying that. You know what I mean? The toughness that he displayed, even going back to those playoff series where he lost to the Pistons, just like the level of physical and mental toughness, the ruggedness that he had, I just think that Michael Jordan was one of those guys that if he was going to be on the court, he was going to try to cut your throat. And there was nothing or no one that was going to get in the way of him doing everything that it took in order to win. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was a learning curve when he made that jump from college to the pros. And after he took his lumps, once the Bulls got that thing turned around, once he set the standard, I just feel like that was going to be it. Like, there wasn't going to be any drop off until he decided that he was just going to walk away.
Really, watching him is one of the most unbelievable, you know, television things I've ever seen. 800-919-3776. People lined up, want to talk about The Last Dance. Let's get to it. Let's start out with Spike in Jersey. Spike, our friend, you're on 98.7 ESPN.
Happy Monday to everybody. I hope everybody had a good Mother's Day. And I watched that. I have not aged well when I saw some of those guys. Let me tell you. First of all, B.J. Armstrong looks 8 years old.
It's ridiculous.
Older. It's ridiculous, and Michael looks great. But when they mentioned the Bradford Smith, it brought me back. Shows you how much I miss hoops, and you guys know I'm a hoops nut. The Bradford Smith team at Louisville had Purvis Ellison on, who might have been the last senior to be the number one pick in the draft, and they had two other guys that had NBA careers with Kenny Page and Felton Spencer. You remember those names? And that was the Denny Crum team, and that team did nothing. And it goes to show you how college basketball has changed. When's the last time a senior was the number one pick in the NBA draft? I mean, that team's 1990, maybe, 89, 90. And you see a guy go off. It shows you one guy, and they said it in this magnificently edited composite of Michael Jordan. I couldn't believe, I hated him. Dave and I talk about this all the time, Sanders. I can't stand him, but boy, was he great.
He was.
And the motivational stuff was off the rails. You get a guy like that on a team, he's going to take no crap from anybody, and it showed you. It showed you. As much as it hurts me to see him, I revel in how great he was. I mean, unbelievable. Who cares if he was a good guy? His team won 6 championships. He could have won 8. I'm saying now, you'll never know, but he could have won 8 championships. I just wish this thing wasn't over in another couple of weeks, you know?
Next week, I think, is thanks for the call, Spike. Next week is the last one, and it's true. I mean, this guy won at all costs. He didn't care if you liked him. He didn't care if you respected him, but you were going to go out there, and you were absolutely going to take care of business so that he had the best chance to win.
That's the part that probably makes me respect him more, Dave, the fact that he didn't care what you thought about him. He didn't care how you felt in that moment. He was going to try to get the best out of you if you were his teammate, and he was going to try to expose you if you were his opponent. Like, it just didn't matter to him. Like, the game and winning is all that mattered to him. And it's hard for me not to respect somebody that has that kind of single-minded focus, because that's so hard to do. Think about today's basketball player, man. We talk about it all the time, how much guys hear the noise, how they're affected by all of the criticism and stuff, and they feel the need to respond. Michael Jordan, the only response you got from him was his performance on the court. He really didn't have a lot of things to say in the media or to anybody else. It was how he played the game that was his response to anything that anybody had to say about him, good or bad. How could you not respect that?
There just aren't many people. I mean, there just aren't many people walking this earth that are equipped to do what he was able to do.
No.
Or that would want to take on that. I mean, would want to take on that burden. I mean, just go back to, I mean, one of the first things I thought of watching that last night was, you know, watching that Troy Aikman football life, how mad he was when Jimmy Johnson
had to be that guy. He was forced to be that
exactly
guy.
Exactly right.
Yep.
That wears on you. I mean, you're so, you know, you want as an athlete, you want as much of the distraction, as much of the burden, you know, off your plate. So you can just be there, single-minded, focused on what you're doing. And he was able to, you know, not only be the best, but, you know, hold all his teammates accountable. And let's not pretend, too, like Phil Jackson didn't know what he was doing, calling ticky-tack fouls.
Oh, Phil knew exactly what he was doing. Phil
knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Phil was a master manipulator, I think it's fair to say. Right? He knew all the right buttons to push, Chris?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I thought it was interesting, though, when Jerry Reinsdorf told Jordan that he had to have the conversation with Phil before he walked away. He had to tell him that he was retiring, and what Phil had to say to MJ. He was saying that, like, you know, a lot of people feel like you're taking something away from them, but that he understood. It almost feels like Phil was like, you're taking something away from me. Like, I got an opportunity to coach what will be known as the savant of this generation basketball players. And you're taking that chance away from me. Like, I don't, like, he didn't know that Michael Jordan was going to come back eventually. Nobody knew that. So, I mean, Phil Jackson was probably looking at the finality of that and saying, you know, this is something that was going to hurt him. This is something that's going to make him feel away. Now, yeah. I'm glad that Jordan was eventually able to come back. But, I mean, think about that, Dave. If you only had those 3 championships from Michael Jordan, I mean, think about how much greatness that we wouldn't have had the chance to witness.
You're right. I mean, and he was how old when he retired the first time? That was after the 93 season. So he was, what, 32? I mean, certainly not an old guy by any stretch. Really in the prime of his career.
Yeah, you could argue that the best of Michael Jordan was yet to come.
Yeah. Yeah, you could. I mean, what he did when he returned was as staggering as what he did before he ever retired. All right, 800-919-3776. Now, today on ESPN Daily, The Last Dance gives a new view of Michael Jordan's dominance, but that was the 90s. Would he be the same star now? Hear how Jordan's game would translate to the modern NBA. That's on ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast. This argument actually annoys me. Both ways. Would Michael Jordan be capable of being great now? And of course he would. And would a guy like LeBron be capable of being great in the 80s or early 90s? Of course he would. Greatness translates generations. These guys would be great in whatever generation they played. These arguments anger me, Chris.
No, I get why they anger you. I don't like them either. I mean, they have the term all-time great for a reason. LeBron James and Michael Jordan are all-time greats. I mean, they're on the Mount Rushmore basketball. But I guess the thing that I look at when you're comparing greats across different eras is the mentality. And not to say that LeBron James is not a killer, but Michael Jordan is on a whole nother level. Like from his mentality standpoint, like he's on a whole nother level, Dave.
But I think he could be like once in a lifetime. I mean,
agreed.
Guys
agreed.
That would make up stories to motivate themselves and you know, I mean, I've never heard or seen, and you guys are professional athletes. Have you ever heard, Rick, of anybody doing anything like this ever?
Yeah, I mean, you've heard stories. I don't know to the degree that Michael Jordan did, or if they were ever as good as Michael Jordan was. I mean, the fact that he's, you know, as great as he was, and he still used, you know, whatever it was, you know, good game Mike or BJ Armstrong celebrating or, George Carl not walking by the table to say hi. Like, that's a different kind of intensity. That's a different kind of, commitment. But, I mean, here's the other thing. Michael Jordan in this era, I mean, I wouldn't be concerned about him. He'd probably be better, but would his teammates be able to handle it?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Would today's athlete be able to handle, you know, being pushed the way Michael Jordan pushed his teammates back then?
I think therein lies the question. I don't know that they would. The votes are in, and tomorrow, May 12th, we're celebrating Derek Jeter by showing a classic Derek Jeter game on ESPN television as part of our MLB Encore Tuesdays. The game that you voted... Chris, guess what it was? The game that you voted on.
Mr. November.
Came out as,
come on, Mr. November.
Mr. November against the Diamondbacks in 2001. You can watch that tomorrow, ESPN television, 7 o'clock, to see the dramatic ninth inning comeback capped by Jeter's walk-off homer in the 10th inning. So I watched part of the preliminary fights on ESPN regular television. I didn't see the pay-per-view portion of it, but it seemed, Chris, like UFC went off pretty well and it was pretty enjoyable on Saturday night.
No, I thought it was awesome, Dave. They did a great job in terms of the broadcast team trying to fill in and bring the overall energy, up. I did think that not having the crowd does take away from the broadcast to a degree, but I thought overall the fights were great. It was entertaining. I really enjoyed it. I really did.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed it too. I mean, to have live sports. I actually didn't mind not having the crowd. I think at the end, you know, Joe Rogan, when he was doing his interviews and, you know, just the habit of, you know, introducing the fighter to, and he's like, oh, to nobody, just because it was new to everybody. But I actually like the fact that you could hear, I mean, each corner's coaches kind of coaching the fighters during the event. I thought was pretty interesting.
So I don't know which fighter it was, but I heard one of the guys was losing his match, and they were analyzing it on television. And he heard what they were saying, and he kind of changed his formula.
Greg Hardy.
Right?
It was Greg Hardy.
That's unbelievable.
No, it is. But, I mean, are you surprised that the guy that played in the NFL can take coaching and adjust on the fly?
No.
I'm not at all.
Interesting, though.
I'm not at all. And the point that they kept making throughout the match was that Greg Hardy's athleticism puts him on a whole nother level in comparison to the other heavyweights that he's going up against. And that was clearly the case going up against DeCastro. Now, he does lack a little bit in technique, and you saw him, you know, continue to get kicked on that lead leg, but he found a way and he kept his overall energy and activity level up, and that's what won him the match. So, I mean, it was, to me, the entire card was entertaining. Like, I watched it from start to finish. I mean, Francis Ngannou, can you say enough about his performance 20 seconds in? Good night, see you later. Like, it was unbelievable to see how he took care of his business in quick fashion. But I mean, there wasn't a moment in any of the fights where you're like, oh, this is kind of boring. Like, you didn't have that. And I think that's exactly what the sports world needed. And that was a huge win for UFC overall.
Did you see Nico Price's eye, by the way? Has anyone seen that picture
yes.
yet of his mm-hmm. eye? Oh. I don't know, man. I want to believe that I would step into the octagon
no, you
and
don't.
Fight.
No, you don't. No, dudes are built differently.
Watching some of these fights, man, no chance. You know, like the what I find the most, I don't even know what the word is, impressive maybe, but like going like that Gaethje fight in the Ferguson fight. I mean, for Ferguson to just to last as long as he lasted, but just in all these fights, like, they brush off these kicks like it's no big deal. Like, can you imagine being kicked in your leg? Like, someone just, as hard as they could, just kicking you in your leg?
No.
How bad
no.
that would hurt?
No, I think you can't walk then, right?
You would crumble.
Yeah.
Most people would just crumble. That'd be it. And these guys,
aside from the fights being entertaining, which I'm sure they were, and I people were really excited about the bulk of the fights, like, it went off well, right? Like, it looked pretty good. It was entertaining. You felt like you're watching real sports. Like, big picture, this was a good return for the sport and for sports on Saturday night, it felt like.
Oh, 100%, Dave. And my biggest takeaway from Saturday night had nothing to do with the UFC. I mean, it had everything to do with the fact that you had a contact sport hold a successful event. And I think that's going to be all the justification that the NFL needs in order to try to move forward with getting the season underway at some point this fall. Like, I mean, I understand you're talking about a lot more people and, you know, being in proximity for a longer duration. But, I mean, if the UFC can find a path forward, I think the NFL is going to try to do something similar. And they're going to have the benefit of being able to have 3 to 4 extra months in order to plan and actually do it. So I thought that that was a huge win for the UFC, but I thought it had implications for the rest of the sports leagues, but the NFL in particular, because you're talking about a sport where you're having a lot of contact between the competitors. So I think that, you know, listen, having live sports back is awesome for us from an entertainment standpoint. And it's something that everybody was looking forward to. But I thought what happened this weekend is going to have implications for what we're going to see this fall.
Yeah, I think the most, I mean, and again, I think it's, you can be optimistic about it, and I get what you're saying. I think the, you know, the one takeaway too was you had a fighter ends up popping positive. So that didn't force the entire event to be shut down. You know, it was him and, you know, two of his cornermen or whatever they were, you know, they all test positive. So they get quarantined. That fight gets canceled and then the rest of the card goes on. But again, you're talking about a situation where you have the fighters flying in before they get to check into the hotel. They all get tested, and then they're allowed into the hotel. Everyone's got an armband. I don't know. I mean, is that going to be possible? Like, you're talking about players not wanting to be part of this whole quarantine situation because they don't want to be away from their families. That's why this thing is working right now with the UFC. Because they test you, now you're allowed into the bubble, and then you get to fight. I mean, you're relying on a lot of guys to do all the right things
right
in order for this to be able to be done.
And this is how many guys? 24, right? Something in that range, plus their corner guys and whatever.
Yeah.
NFL game is a lot more than that. I don't know if you saw, Chris, Peter King interviewed Dr. Fauci.
I did.
For this week's Football Morning in America. And, you know, Fauci basically just said, we don't know. He said he thinks there's a chance and the virus will kind of dictate what happens down the road in September, October, November, and hopefully if and when we get a football season this year.
And Dr. Fauci also went on to say that it is possible, and he said that if you are going to be able to pull it off, it's going to have to include widespread testing. I think he proposed, you know, testing everybody, players and coaches, twice a week, and that would ultimately lead to the NFL needing something like 200,000 tests for a season. And he said it felt a little piggish now to ask for those tests, but it's not outside of the realm of possibility to think that 3 months from now will be in a place where that is an available option and you're not taking tests away from folks that actually need it. So to me, I actually thought that was optimistic.
Right.
If he felt like they were going to be able to have the test that they needed available in order to have a successful return to football. So, I mean, yeah, Dave, nobody can say with any degree of certainty where we'll be once August rolls around and it becomes time for guys to report to training camp, but I think that based on what we saw this weekend and the overall direction of where things are going in terms of what's happening to the spread of this virus across this country, I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility to have 3 months from now teams actually reporting for training camps and having practices. I don't.
Yeah, see, I think the other thing too, and I think that's really, I mean, where we're at is you don't know what this thing will look like a week from now, let alone, you know, months from now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the one thing that has to change is the conversation surrounding COVID-19. like the context in which we look at COVID-19. Like it needs to, because football is, and Chris, you've been a part of locker rooms. I mean, flu goes through a locker room in a hurry, right? But it's the flu. So, I mean, it'll affect guys differently, but it's not life-threatening. Guys will play through it. You know, some guys can't. I think we need to get to that point where I don't think it's a vaccine. I think it's got to be a treatment. Like, they have to find a way to treat this. So
yeah, so if you get it, you don't die from it.
Yes.
Exactly right.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly
yes.
right. So yeah. If that's the conversation, then I think you'll get to a point where between the testing and everything else, guys will be more willing to take that risk. As opposed to now where you have really, I mean, no one has any good answers for you. Well, hey, doc, how's it going to affect me? Well, guess what? I can't really, maybe it doesn't. Who knows? Maybe it does. Maybe you end up on a ventilator. We don't know. That's not good enough for a lot of guys at the moment.
I think as we get more drugs that are available for treatment and including that in the protocol on how you handle COVID-19, I think that ultimately is what's going to shift the conversation around the coronavirus, Rick. And so, yeah, we could be in that place a couple of months from now. I mean, in that article that Peter King did, he said 2 months ago, we were still going out to eat at restaurants.
Right.
And that was March 11th. So, I mean, it's a situation where things can change quickly. And this is, you know, continuing to unfold, continuing to evolve. But I think because you have the best minds in the world working towards solutions to this pandemic, that sooner rather than later, we're going to have better treatment options. We're going to have a vaccine for this virus. So I guess that's why I'm choosing to have some hope that football season will eventually happen this fall. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to start on time, but I do think we'll have NFL football this fall.
And Mark Emmert finally came out and said something you've been saying for weeks and weeks, Chris, and that is if kids are not on campus, we're not playing college football in the fall.
Yeah, it's just not happening, Dave. Now, I texted with somebody that used to work in the Virginia Athletic Department, and they said that, yeah, that's if they don't have campus open and they don't have a part or the entire student body on campus, then they can't have the student athletes on campus. Now, the question then becomes, well, what does it mean when you say the campus is open? You know, I think that's when you have an area of gray where you can say, well, you know, we have campus open for a select amount or a select part of the student population. And because we're doing that, then maybe we can justify having the student athletes on campus. But I just think it's dangerous when you have the entity that's responsible for protecting these kids also be the entity that benefits the most from having them go out there and play.
Yeah.
But Dave, I mean, I think what's scarier is, I mean, it sounds like the more we hear about this stuff and the more people you listen to and talk to, that a lot of these Power Fives could care less what Mark Emmert has to say. Like, they're happy making their own decisions.
Which is scary.
Well, it is scary. I mean, Chris, to Chris's point, I mean, I heard this morning. It's almost like what we're doing now. Like, I mean, you know, there are certain people that need to be in the studio to get us on the air. We don't need to be in the studio because we can do it from our houses. It'd be like the same thing. Like, okay, whatever school it is, we're open. We're going to say we're open. We're going to offer, you know, kids that don't need to be here, you can take your classes online, and then whoever we need here, it's essential, like the football players, then they'll be required to come in and be at school and be on campus.
It's a scary thought. I mean, to have the school partially open and to have football games taking place, and that's not far off. I mean, college football is soon.
Well, Joe Burrow took all his classes online, which I thought was interesting. I didn't even realize that.
I'm sure you're saying classes with air quotes, right?
Yes. Oh, okay. Oh no. This whole conversation is all air quotes. No. Listen, the hypocrisy of the whole thing is we all get it. Like, we all understand that. That's, I mean, we've had plenty of those conversations. But that's, I mean, these will be some of the, you know, fugazi ways they get around, you know, trying to keep this whole, the charades of these are student athletes when we all realize that they're not.
But let me ask you this question, Rico, and this is the part where it gets a little confusing for me when it comes to college football. What's lost by delaying the college football season to the spring semester? I just think with college football, especially when you're talking about teenagers and young 20-somethings, you should try to buy as much time as you possibly can in order to make sure you have the best available options in terms of being able to deal with one of these kids getting infected with the virus. I just that's the part of it that doesn't make sense to me. Like these Power Five conferences, I get that there's a lot of money on the line. But to me, I think you would try to delay it as much as you possibly can, especially when you consider the fact that a lot of their revenue comes from ticket sales. I mean, if you push this thing off until January, February, and there's a vaccine available, maybe you don't have to make the tough decision on whether or not to play games without fans in stadiums. Maybe that's not something you even have to worry about. I just feel like you give yourself more options if you give yourself more time.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I guess the only answer to your question would be maybe the uncertainty of who knows. Like, I would, listen, I'm of the same mindset. I think the NHL should start up later, and I think the NBA should start up later with you know, the 20, whatever it ends up being, 2020-21 season.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, if it's feasible, like, if you could make that work, if schedule-wise you could come up with something that starts, you know, more like in the spring, I would want to give myself as much time as possible to get some answers to these questions.
Yeah. And the more time you have, the better treatments, vaccines, ideas that you would have. So it does seem to make sense. But bottom line is they probably want to get these games played because that brings in the money. And the sooner they get the money, the happier they'll be.
Which is really sad because it doesn't sound like they have the best interests of the kids in mind.
No. But this might be the biggest, but that's not the first time we felt like this from the NCAA, is it?
No, it's not the first time we felt like this from the NCAA. And as far as the pro sports trying to get things ramped back up, like I can understand it because you're talking about grown men that are making decisions and they have, more maturity and they can be more responsible about it. You can't ask, you know, I just think it's ridiculous to ask those college kids to put themselves in harm's way, especially when you don't have to have the level of urgency to have them out there this fall. That's the only thing that bothers me about this whole situation.
Now, Rick, my understanding is the big guest is waiting in with us. Is that correct? You've done some magical work here?
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a great start to the week with this noon hour.
All right, let's bring him in. I mean, really, the face of ESPN, the wonderful and talented Mike Greenberg. Good afternoon, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, fellas. I will admit, like a lot of other New Yorkers, I'm probably feeling a little sad today because of the news about Jerry Stiller. I can't be the only one in this conversation who thinks that's the greatest Seinfeld is the greatest television show of all time. And I spent my drive home today while listening to you guys thinking about all of the incredibly funny things he did on Seinfeld. So I'm sure a lot of people in New York are thinking about him today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my favorite show. I mean, it's right in my wheelhouse when I was, you know, finishing high school, getting into my 20s, and the humor is so brilliant. Have you ever seen, Greeny, the outtakes where they're at the police station and Elaine just can't finish the scene because he's just cracking her up every single time?
Yes, when he keeps saying, "You want a piece of me?"
Yes.
I tweeted just now, if you forced me to pick my favorite Seinfeld episode, and it's hard to do, I think I would pick The Caddy, which is the episode where, among other things, they think that George is dead, and George Steinbrenner goes mm-hmm. to Frank and Estelle's house to inform them that George is dead. And immediately, Jerry Stiller, as Frank Costanza, launches into a rant in which he says, "What the hell did you trade Jay Buna for?" And it might be my single favorite moment in the history of that show. So he was so damn funny.
So funny and sadly passes away at the age of 92. And I still watch, do you still watch it every night, Greeny?
Yes.
11 o'clock, I still turn on Seinfeld. It feels like it's the show that it never is outdated. It's always good.
Well, it's interesting, and this is, I'm sure, not what you guys called me to talk about today, so I won't sidetrack us so much. But interestingly, I don't know if your kids are probably too young for this, but my kids watch Friends religiously on Netflix and will not watch Seinfeld because Seinfeld is so of its time. They find it very dated. It was very much of its era. And so you and I find it incredibly funny because we remember that era, and it doesn't feel like all that long ago. But whereas Friends seems to have maintained a level of popularity, I'm talking about much younger people. I'm talking about teenagers. So I still watch Seinfeld religiously. But my kids, they think it is – I mean, there's an entire episode that is built around George waiting for a call on a payphone in the coffee shop from Tatiana, and that just does not register with my kids.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I still watch and think it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. Oh, I think it would pain me. I think if I offered it to my kids and they watch it and like, Dad, this just isn't funny, which there's a good chance that would happen, it would actually pain me.
Oh, it pains me. Yeah, you have no idea the pain. I mean, it pains me enormously. They don't like my music. They don't like my television. I can't talk them into much. Anyway, what's going on, fellas? I'm sorry that I sidetracked the conversation before it even began.
Oh, stop. All right, so Greedy's with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So, obviously, Sam Darnold's on the K-Show today, 5:30. I'm sure you're going to be listening to that. We haven't talked to you since pre-draft for the Jets. So, tell us, what did you think? How do you feel about Joe Douglas in year one and how he did in the draft for his first go-around?
Mostly very good. The more I look at the pick of the tackle in the first round, the more I like it. I will confess that at the moment, as I watched that with my son that night, we were hoping that the Jets would take one of the explosive receivers, the Jerry Jeudy, C.D. Lamb. They were sitting there for them if they wanted them. And my first reaction was that's what they really needed. But the more thought I have given to it, the more I have come to feel that the best thing the Jets can do right now on offense for Sam is to build that line. And they have remade their offensive line completely this offseason, and that's probably the right thing for them to do. And if that comes together well, that's probably the best thing they can do for the development of Darnold. The receiver they take on the second round obviously is, I mean, fast as lightning and has all the physical tools. Everything I've read about him and heard from the people who cover it for us is that he's very raw. If he turns into a good player, then this will wind up having been a really good draft. And then the big question, though, with the Jets will remain that on the offensive side, aside from Crowder and I guess Le'Veon Bell, who is Darnold going to be throwing the ball to? And if the answer to that question can be found in a meaningful way, then I think the Jets have a chance to as tough as the schedule is, and it is brutal, if they don't get buried early like they did a year ago, I think they have a chance to be in playoff contention most of the year because I think New England is falling back to the pack. And I'm not buying on Buffalo as much as most other people are.
Greeny, I want to get into, you know, some of the stuff last night with The Last Dance because you covered that. I mean, you lived that. But since we're on the Jets, I guess I'll ask you the Jets question first. So in saying all of that, I mean, if I were to ask you now, you know, outside of maybe potentially weapons, you as a Jets fan, what is your biggest concern with this team as we approach this upcoming season? Well, is it still potentially, you know, you don't trust the coach?
Well, certainly. That's a huge one. But that hasn't changed from the end of the season. If I had to look at the way they've remade or what the work they've done on the roster concerns I have or the questions I have there surround, A, the weapons on the outside on offense, and then, B, what's going to happen with Jamal Adams? And what do you guys think? What ultimately is going to happen here? Because I have very mixed feelings. Look, I love the kid, and he's obviously a great player. And there's not a team in the NFL that would not be made better by having him. But I do wonder if in the way football is played in 2020, if building your defense, if you're just sort of assigning amounts of money to different positions on the field, if building your defense around a safety is the way to do it. And again, I'm not in any way diminishing him. I don't think you can play that position any better than he does. But I just wonder if that's where you want to spend all of that money. So I was watching with really close interest how they would handle that, and I'll be very interested to see where it goes from here.
Well, I guess when you're not paying your quarterback top of the market money, you do have the luxury of being able to overpay at a position like safety. It's not necessarily one of those spots where you feel like NFL teams would prioritize those guys getting paid top of the market money. So it just seems like it would make sense while you have Sam still on his rookie contract that you would go ahead and reward one of the actual draft picks that you used in the top 10 that panned out.
Yes. Look, again, I hear you, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. And if they decide to make Adams the highest paid safety in the sport, I will not complain. He absolutely deserves it. I guess the question is, are you then putting yourself in a position when you do have to pay Darnold? I guess ultimately Bell won't be there forever. You know, they're going to have a lot of money to move around and all of that, but they're going to pay Darnold. I remain a believer in Darnold. I think he's going to be terrific. And I think he's going to be the Jets quarterback for the next decade plus, which means they're going to have to pay him big money at some point. And that's going to sort of reshuffle things. And the most valuable thing to have to the point that you're making and the entire NFL right now is a quarterback on a rookie contract. You want to win while that's happening. So they basically have another year or two to do that. But I guess two, really. You don't have to redo the deal after year three, although, you know, if some teams had, they might be in a better position than they are now. So the time to try and win is right now. Brady is gone. Arnold's on a rookie contract. This is the time. And I think if everything breaks their way, they have a chance.
And Greeny, I want to revisit the questions that we have around Adam Gase as the head coach for this team. Everybody gave him a pass last year because it was his first season with the team. You still had Mike Maccagnan running the offseason with free agency in the draft before you decided to part company with him. But what are the expectations for Adam Gase from Jets fans coming into 2020? What does this season have to look like for you in order to have confidence in your head coach moving forward?
Well, let's see. I want Le'Veon Bell to have the ball about three times more than he had it last year and in more creative ways. I understand that Gase didn't want him, but you've got him. And he is an extraordinarily expensive and potentially dynamic weapon that you have on your team. He's the only offensive weapon they have on their team that other teams are going to be even remotely afraid of. So find creative ways to use him. My biggest issue with Gase all through last year from start to finish was that he obviously didn't want Bell, and I thought that he had an agenda with that the entire season long. Throw out the time that Darnold had mono because that was just an unbridled disaster that nothing was going to overcome. But to me, the time for making the point that you didn't want this guy in the first place is long since over. Le'Veon Bell has another, call it 2 or 3 years, to be one of the truly great dynamic offensive weapons in the National Football League. Take advantage of that starting immediately. That's what I want to see.
Greeny's with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So you said, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, that Darnold is going to be a really good quarterback, going to be here for a long time. But do you feel kind of this slow groundswell? Because we even have hosts here at the station where if he doesn't have a big-time year this year, I'm going to start looking for another quarterback. I don't know. It seems so strange to me, but it feels like this really is a very big year for Sam Darnold.
I agree. I agree with your premise that people seem to be talking that way, which candidly, I don't get at all. I thought Darnold Darnold is still younger than Joe Burrow, who won the Heisman this past year and is coming in as a rookie. I mean, Darnold is very young and left 2 years of college on the table. It was always going to take a little time, and then changed offensive systems and got mono going into his second year. And yes, he still has the extraordinarily frustrating habit of throwing a lot of interceptions and particularly throwing them at the most crippling of possible times. But that's what Adam Gase is for. He's supposed to be the quarterback whisperer. That's why he is the head coach of the New York Jets, and it's his job to coach up Darnold. I think Darnold has as much talent, just pure talent, as any quarterback the Jets have had in my lifetime. I'm not old enough to have seen Namath in his prime. I've never seen the Jets have a quarterback as talented as this guy is, from Richard Todd on until the present day. So it's the coach's job to turn him into a great player, which I think he absolutely has the potential to be. And if Jet fans are thinking about Trevor Lawrence or anything like that, forget it. First of all, they're not going to be terrible this year. The Jaguars are tanking for Trevor Lawrence. The Jaguars are doing everything they can not to win any games this year. Second of all, I'm not even sure Trevor Lawrence is going to be the first pick in the draft next year. Ohio State has a quarterback named Justin Fields that by the end of next season may surpass him. And third of all, we should be rallying around the idea that Darnold is going to be the franchise quarterback for the next 15 years. That's the best thing that could happen to the franchise, and I think it's going to happen.
Well, lucky for your sanity, Greeny, we have Frank Gore now to lessen the load on Lev Bell, so I'm sure you're going to love that.
I don't have a problem with bringing in someone else to get some carries. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is I cannot remember off the top of my head one moment last year where I thought to myself, wow, that was using Le'Veon Bell in a really creative way. I mean, what the hell? He's supposed to be an offensive genius. Find creative ways to use this incredibly dynamic, unique weapon. I mean, he was I don't need to remind everyone of all the numbers. He averaged more yards rushing per game than Emmitt Smith and more receiving yards per game than Chris Carter. He's a Hall of Fame runner and receiver. And the Jets turned him into just a run-of-the-mill good back last year. That's terrible. And, I'm willing to write off the entire first half of the season. But find creative ways to use that guy. That's the number one thing I want to see.
All right, Greeny, let me ask you a Chicago Bulls-related question, because that's why I really wanted you on, because you live this. I mean, what would you say, and I really loved the two episodes we got a chance to watch last night, but, I mean, we took some phone calls today talking about Michael Jordan punching Steve Kerr, and he was a bad teammate. Well, what would you say to someone that thinks that Michael Jordan was a bad teammate?
I think you would have to say, and listen, I would defer to you and Chris on this as former players. Here's my vantage point from one who covered it all. I don't think that playing for Bill Belichick is a lot of fun. But the only thing less fun than playing for Bill Belichick is losing a lot. So if you think winning is fun and winning is the ultimate objective, then playing with Michael Jordan in the end was the best thing that could happen to you. I don't think that every minute of the time that it was going on, you would have felt that way. Jordan demanded of others their very best at all times and was willing to give it himself at all times. I don't think that made him, I don't think that would have made him a fun person to be around. But ultimately, I think that was his vision of leading. That was the way he viewed leadership. I think that was what he perceived to be the best way he could to give his teams and himself the best chance to win championships, which was his singular goal. And he did it better than anyone of his era and about as well as anyone in the history of American team sports. So I think it's very difficult to take that away from him. If you want to suggest that leading that way, that being that tough on your teammates makes you not a great teammate, I'm not going to argue with you, because I don't know that I would have had a lot of fun playing with him. But I bet you that when Steve Kerr, who got punched in that famous time, or Will Perdue, who called him what he called him on TV last night, and all these other guys, when they open up their safety deposit box and see those rings, I bet you they don't think about how nasty Michael was to them, but they think about the great moments and the huge wins and the championships. And if that's what it's all about, then I think it was worth the trade-off. I'll also tell you that having been around, it was my job to cover Michael Jordan every single day for almost 6 years, that being around him in that capacity, he was as easy to deal with and as nice and as likable and as reasonable a person, considering his stature, considering that at that time, I believe he was the most famous person in the world. He was remarkably easy to deal with, and I saw him in moments that demonstrated that he was just he was, and I believe is, a decent person. But I think that he, and I mean that in a, that almost sounds like underdoing it. I think he's a good person, but I think that his competitiveness, his almost excruciating competitive drive, probably made him difficult to be around rather regularly. And if you think that makes him a bad teammate, I'm not going to try and argue.
You know what, Greeny? There's something about it that I respect. When you have an athlete that understands the cost of winning and is unwilling to compromise that and unwilling to allow his teammates to compromise that, I think that that's something that's really special. But since we're talking about the cost of winning, I got to ask you about Stephen Jones' comments regarding the Dak Prescott contract this weekend. They said they're not going to rescind the tag, but clearly the two sides are still apart on this, and I understand there's some disagreement about the structure of the deal. Jeff Darlington talking about the years being a sticking point. To me, this is one of those situations where Jerry and Stephen Jones are compromising the opportunity to capitalize on a championship window that they have created by drafting and developing a lot of good players. Am I wrong for looking at it that way?
Well, I think you're not. Not only are you not wrong, but I think you're not even going far enough in the criticism. What the Joneses are doing makes no logical sense, or at least has no logical consistency to what they have done previously. So Stephen Jones cannot this year say, we have statistics and analytics that demonstrate you can't pay the quarterback above a certain amount. A year after ripping up Ezekiel Elliott's contract and without absolutely any leverage, making Zeke Elliott the highest paid running back in the National Football League, when the last time an NFL leading rusher won the Super Bowl was in a previous millennium, and the last team to lead the league in rushing and win the Super Bowl was the 85 Bears. So there is nowhere that you look in the analytics book of NFL and say, oh yeah, rip up the contract of your running back long before you have to and pay him while he's in Cabo. Not only does it make no sense from an analytics standpoint, but it also sends the absolute wrong message to all the rest of the players on your team, which is the squeaky wheel really does get the grease here. So it doesn't matter if what Stephen Jones is saying is right or wrong. It completely contradicts the way they have done business previously. So for the life of me, I have no idea what they're doing with Dak, and I have no idea where it's going to go from here.
Well, as a Giants fan, I kind of love the direction that it's headed right now, and I don't have a lot on my plate when it comes to Big Blue. Greeny with us here, 98.7 ESPN. What were the years that you covered Jordan and the Bulls, Mike?
91 through 96.
91 through 96. So you were there when the Knicks played them both in, I mean, 92 and in 94. You were there. You were at the game where Pippen wouldn't go back into the game with 1.8
correct.
Seconds left, huh?
Yes.
So what was the feeling around that? I mean, you watch it now and it's such an awful look and it feels like it was similar back then. Were you shocked by that?
Yes. I can tell you three things that happened. Okay. That completely changed the history of it. So Scottie Pippen refuses to go back into a tie game with 1.8 seconds left at home on a Friday night in a game three down 2-0. The first thing that then happens is that Kukoc throws in a very tough shot to win game three. If that shot doesn't go in, the Bulls are going to lose in overtime. They're going to get swept, and that is going to become the biggest thing. It is going to completely change Scottie Pippen's legacy. But that doesn't happen. Kukoc makes the shot. The next thing that happens is that game was played on a Friday night, and game four was played on a Sunday afternoon in Chicago. So there were basically 36 hours between those two games. There wasn't a lot of time for it to sink in. I was on the radio in Chicago at that time, and I remember spending an entire day talking about it. But that's all we had was one day to talk about it, because the Bulls then came back and won game four, which sends the series back to New York for game five, which is where the third and most important thing happens. The Hugh Hollins call, I can tell you guys right now, I'm a New Yorker who grew up a Knicks season ticket holder and lived and died with the Knicks all of my life. I then went to Chicago to cover the Bulls, and so I can tell you those series were viewed completely differently from the two sides. So while I'm sure that series is not always remembered for the Hugh Hollins foul call in Game 5 in New York, it most certainly is in Chicago. To this day, that is known as the Hugh Hollins game, and it changed the narrative completely. And, of course, it changes the outcome of the series. The Knicks wind up winning Game 5, which they would not have. Chicago wins Game 6 at home, but the Knicks win Game 7 easily, and that's the end of that. History is completely rewritten, if not for that foul call. That is now exclusively the way people remember that series in Chicago. It's like Scottie not going back into that game with 1.8 seconds, incredibly, is an afterthought when people remember that series, because they believe that they in Chicago, the fans and the team, believe they fought their way back in, that they would have won the series, but they got robbed on a bad call in Game 5 in the Garden. So those three things, I think, are the reasons that Scottie Pippen is not remembered much more for those 1.8 seconds than he is. He should thank his lucky stars every day, because it is one of the worst moves that you've ever seen a great player make in your entire life. It is, again, to Rick and to Chris, I would say, is there any worse sin that a player can commit than saying, when the game is on the line, at any time for that matter, but when the game is on the line, no, I'm not going in right now. I can't think of another time I've seen it happen, and I can't think of a worse thing a player can do. So I think he is very, very fortunate that the three things I just listed for you happened, which have made that moment almost completely forgotten.
Hey, Greeny, and I wanted to ask you a question regarding that. I mean, how surprised were you to hear, you know, Scottie Pippen actually say if he could go back, he wouldn't change it? That seemed kind of ridiculous.
I have no idea what he's saying. I mean, because he leading up to that, every comment he made suggested he understands how terrible it was. and he tearfully apologized to his teammates right after it happened. And Bill Cartwright, who was a great leader, actually, on those teams, you saw him wearing him out on the bench. And apparently, after the game in the locker room, and this was the story at the time and remains, that Cartwright was practically uncontrollable. He was so angry and screaming at Pippen, and that Scottie tearfully apologized. So for him to say all of those things and then say, but if I had to do it again, I would do it the same way, it just doesn't make any sense to me at all. Candidly, and in my opinion, and I haven't had the opportunity to talk to Scottie about this, it's a ridiculous thing to say, because I think he recognizes just how wrong it was. And I would think that if he had the opportunity to do it again, he would do it the absolute opposite way.
Greeny, since you were around the team and covering them, I think you're the perfect person to ask this question. Right after Michael Jordan's father passed, I thought it was a little unfair that people were trying to create this connection between his untimely demise and Michael Jordan's addiction to gambling. Did you feel like that in real time?
Yeah. So there were two schools. There were two groups of people in Chicago, and I think beyond Chicago at that time. Those who did and those who didn't believe in the conspiracy theories. There were two conspiracy theories that I've never believed. One of them is Michael Jordan prematurely retired because David Stern surreptitiously suspended him for 18 months for gambling and didn't want the world to know about it because it would have been a scandal that brought down the NBA. That was a theory that was espoused by credible people, not just people. Well, there was no internet then, but, you know, not just voices on the internet, but credible people would say that out loud. I've never believed it to be true. I didn't believe it then. I don't believe it now. The other thing that credible people believed and said out loud was that if it felt possible that there was a connection between Michael Jordan's gambling and the tragic murder of his father. I have never believed that, didn't believe it then, and do not believe it now. I do believe that Michael's father's murder is the reason that he retired. I think he was spent emotionally, physically. Just think back to where he was then. 91, he wins the championship. 92, he wins the championship. Both grueling. Did not want to go to the Olympics in the summer of 92, but that was the dream team. It was the biggest thing ever. The NBA wasn't going to let him not go, and Nike wasn't going to let him not go. So he spent the entire summer of 92 playing with the dream team and then comes back and wins another title in 93. So he is exhausted emotionally, physically, mentally, and in every other way. And then his father gets killed. I believe tragically, coincidentally, and having nothing to do with anything except sometimes tragic things happen. And I believe that the combination of all of that was too much for him to handle. And he just said, you know what, I need to get away. And that's what he did. And he couldn't go back to training camp and start because the season was getting ready to start soon, or at least the preseason. And so that was why he retired. So that I've always thought. But I've never believed that there was any connection between Jordan's gambling and his father's murder, and I've never believed that the NBA secretly suspended him. But I can tell you back then that lots of people, real people, credible people, did believe both of those things.
Mike Greenberg is with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So did you follow Jordan into kind of the baseball realm when he retired from the NBA and follow him there, or did you stay on,
yes,
on the Bulls? You
did. I followed him. I went to Sarasota, Florida, in the spring of 1994, where I lived in a house, true story. There were four of us that went there. The first day that Jordan was in spring training, there were probably 500 reporters there. Ted Koppel did Nightline from there. Cool. By the end of the first week, there were four of us. There was the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Daily Herald, which is a suburban paper, and me. The other three reporters who were there all stayed in the only hotel in Sarasota, which was the Ritz-Carlton. My station did not have anywhere near the budget to put me in the Ritz-Carlton. So I rented a room in a house on Siesta Key. The other five residents of the house were women, median age 87.
So it's your Del Boca Vista moment.
I lived there for the entirety of the time that Michael was in spring training. He was with the major league team for most of it. Then when they sent him to Birmingham, the Birmingham Barons of AA, managed by Terry Francona, that was when I went back to Chicago. They did not send me to Birmingham. So I was with him for the entirety of the time that he was in Sarasota.
Greeny, do you get the sense that he would have stayed in baseball if it wasn't for the strike?
No. I am surprised he stayed with it as long as he did. Michael Jordan, and I think you all saw this last night, Michael Jordan was consumed with being the best in the world at something. And he wasn't anywhere near the best in the world at baseball. To say that if Michael Jordan had gotten 1,500 at-bats, he would have made the major leagues is being very kind and also being very, very phony. I was there. Michael Jordan, by normal human standards, was a very good baseball player. He would not have made the major leagues, in any real way. I suppose they could have put him in the major leagues because he was Michael Jordan. But if his name had been, you know, Michael Horowitz, he would have had less chance of making the major leagues back then than I did. Now, I'm not saying if he had stuck with it from the time he was 17, he couldn't have done it. Maybe he could have. I don't know. Although not too many guys who were 6'6 make it as outfielders because his strike zone was so big. But I was there to watch every single game he played in spring training. And I'm telling you, and I'm not a baseball scout, but when you watch them play, you guys know where the press box is located. Practically every baseball stadium in the world, it is located high above home plate. So the view you get of the outfield is, as a reporter, is when you see a fly ball hit, you immediately see the outfielders start moving. And it was not until I covered Michael Jordan that I recognized how great the major league outfielders are. Because if you ever watch a major league game, the second the ball is hit, the crack of the bat, these guys are on a dead run to exactly the right spot immediately. Every one of them, practically every time. Michael Jordan took at least two steps in the wrong direction every time a fly ball was hit to the outfield. And that's not because he isn't a great athlete. It's because he hadn't played thousands and thousands and thousands of innings in the outfield, which you have to do in order to be a major league player. So Michael Jordan was never going to be a major league baseball player. And he knew it pretty quickly. And I think I can't believe it took him as long as it did to say, I need to go back there and be the best basketball player in the world again, which there was never any question in his mind or mine that he could do. So I am almost a little surprised that he didn't go back sooner. Now, he was not going to allow himself to be used as a pawn in the CBA stuff. That is true. But he was not going to be a major league player anyway. I think he was always going to go back to basketball.
Greeny, over the weekend, we had a return to contact sports with UFC 249. I'm interested to get your overall thoughts on how you think the UFC did, but I also want to know what you think this means for other sports leagues as we try to ramp things back up.
Well, I think they did well. I think that the initial reaction everyone had when one of the fighters tested positive for the virus was the wrong one, or at least it was mine was. When I first heard one of the fighters tested positive, I thought, oh, no, is the event in jeopardy? But as I came to think about it, and I heard Dana say afterwards, it actually means the system worked. They had the testing. They were able to find an athlete who was positive, identify him, get him whatever assistance he needs, go through the proper protocols with him, and keep everyone else safe. So I think, and I'm certainly wide open to someone pointing out to me something that I'm not aware of that would change my opinion, I think it was a huge success. And the position I've taken, guys, on my show, and just as a person who loves sports since this all began, is it costs you the same to be optimistic as it does to be pessimistic. So I'm going to be optimistic. But I'm also not going to be unrealistic. I'm not going to lie to my audience. I'm extraordinarily hopeful that there will be a method figured out or methods figured out that sports, the baseball, the basketball, the hockey, ultimately football, and all the rest can come back in such a way that it does not compromise the safety and health of anyone, of the players, of coaches, of support people, and of fans. If that can be done, I will be delighted because I miss sports, and I think all of us who love sports do, and I think it would be wonderful for the national psyche to have something fun to cheer for again. Realistically speaking, I do not believe we are going to see packed stadiums again this year, certainly not in New York. I know they're talking about down in the south, you know, in the southern part of the country, the SEC and all of that, playing with fans. Time will tell. But I do believe, let me put it this way, I believe that the people who run the NBA believe, the people who run Major League Baseball believe, and the people who run the National Football League believe that they're going to play this year. In some fashion, with the fans in some way probably incrementally increasing. And if so, I think that would be a great win because I think all of us miss it. And so long as it can be done safely, I think it would be great for everyone, both financially and otherwise, to see these games come back, because I think they're an important part of our culture, and I think it will make a big difference, again, if safely they can return.
Greeny, last one for me. Mike Greenberg here with us on 98.7 ESPN. You're similar to me. We love our teams. We live and we die with them. We can't get enough of them. You're a Knicks fan. You grew up in New York, and then you go out to Chicago, you go to Northwestern, you get a job covering the Bulls. How hard was that? I mean, you're a Knicks fan. The Knicks were a terrific basketball team, and they had so many opportunities, and every time they did, you're there covering the Bulls, watching your beloved Knicks lose. I mean, is that something that was difficult? Are you such a straight-focused journalist that you can just watch the Bulls, enjoy the game as someone covering that team, and not get caught up in the fact that you love the Knicks?
It was a little bit of both. So my parents... my father was still alive then, and my parents are crazy sports fans. In fact, you know, Dave, when your dad died, that beautiful piece that I read about him that Mike Vaccaro wrote, it reminded me very much, you know, that relationship reminded me very much of that with my father, although mm-hmm. my father would have taken me to the Super Bowl anyway. I could have gotten straight Fs, and my father would have taken me to the Super Bowl anyway, but that's neither here nor there. So I'm traveling back and forth between Chicago and New York, and when I'm in New York, I'm staying in my parents' apartment, My parents owned a store that had a huge Go New York, Go New York, Go sign in the window. So, like, we're crazy Knicks fans on one side. And on the other side, I'm hosting radio shows and doing reports on the station where we're taking call after call after call from Bulls fans. It wasn't as hard as you would think because I don't know, Dave, much about your history covering. Were you always a talk guy? Were you out there covering stuff?
Well, I lived in Raleigh for a while and I covered the Carolina Hurricanes. But okay. If and when they played the Rangers, I rooted for the Rangers.
You can root for the Rangers, but I don't know, at least in my case, I got very wrapped up in what I was doing. So when the games are going on, when I was doing in locker rooms doing interviews, when I was working, I wasn't really thinking about that part of it. When I had private time, like when I was sitting alone by myself, yes. But I was in the building when Starks, I was walking down. I remember where I was standing when Starks dunked left-handed on Jordan and Pippen at the end of game two in 93. And I remember thinking to myself as I was walking down, oh, my God, the Knicks are going to beat Michael Jordan. I mean, they're going to win. And I was very, very happy about that. But then I was in there, and I'm interviewing Riley and interviewing Phil and doing all the rest of the work you have to do, and I wasn't really thinking about it. So I don't think it interfered with my ability to cover the series, but there's no question I was rooting for the Knicks. And when the Knicks won in 94 and went on to the finals, which was really the first time in my lifetime that I had seen the Knicks have a chance to play for a championship. I'm not old enough to remember 73. I was 5 years old. I don't really have any recollection of that. My favorite Knicks teams in the early 90s were the Bernard King teams, the Hubie teams. Those were the closest they ever came, taking Boston to 7 and 84 and some of that stuff. So in 94 was the first time I ever saw the Knicks play for a championship, and that broke my heart. The Starks game in game 6 and everything else, the terrible call, the offensive foul on Ewing in game 3 of that series were devastating for me. But when they were playing the Bulls and I was working as closely with that as I was, most of the time I was too busy to really think about it that way.
All right, Mike, listen, we'd love to keep you forever. We do have to run a couple commercials. You're welcome on anytime. I mean, we'll talk Jets, we'll talk Knicks, we'll talk history, we'll talk whatever. So it's an open invitation on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me. It's good to catch up. And I'm thrilled to see people enjoying this this last dance because – It's like looking back into my youth. It was the most thrilling experience of my professional life. I was 24 years old when I started on the road with those guys, and it was just an amazing experience. So I'm so glad everyone's having such a good time watching it.
It really is great. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Thank you.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg, weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.